Gentile, welcome inside the Crazy Ant Farm. How are you?
I'm doing really good. How are you guys today?
Oh, man, we are living the dream, as always, living the dream. I got to tell you, we are really excited to talk to you. These two documentaries that you're behind are just, I feel like they're conversation starters. They're necessary to have conversations about. I personally, when I was watching the family documentary, the Erasing the Family, I went through a very nasty divorce and custody battle, and I was on the end of being the parent that was trying to be erased and not allowed to see my child for a certain extent, and the judge was very anti-dad, and it was very powerful and very moving. The entire time I was watching it, I was like, oh my gosh, I've literally been through everything she's talking about right now. So I can't wait to dive into that. And then obviously the school thing, you know, having that same daughter that just finished college and all the kind of, I'm so excited. I know you are.
Yeah, there's a lot of different things we're going to dive into. But first, we want to introduce you to the audience. Let them know how you got started in this industry. Was it something you always wanted to do? Because you're telling very important stories in a very interesting way. You're actually our first ever documentarian that we have had on. So we're super excited about it. We love documentaries. So this is an absolute honor to have you on. So how did you get started and how did you want to start telling stories like this?
So I got started, I think I made my first documentary film when I was 15. And I actually have never finished it. I'm not sure where the tapes are. I'd love to find them. And it was a documentary on junior prom because I thought it was the most stupid thing ever. I interviewed all my friends as to why they wanted to go to this stupid thing. And I'm not sure if I realized at the time, but I had a talent for getting people to say very intimate things on camera. And I have an ability to make people feel very comfortable. So they say things to me. So that's something I kind of just thought about. And then I went to college. I went to Columbia University in New York City, which plays into one of my films. And I studied history. And after I got my degree, I wanted to learn Spanish. So I bounced around Latin America, ended up in Argentina. And I was there for, I stayed there for 13 years.
Wow.
And when I was in Argentina, I had this thought, well, I really don't know how to do anything. Like, I have this degree in history, but like, I don't know how to build a house. I don't know how to do anything practical. I don't really have a marketable skill. And someone suggested directing movies. And I was like, that's okay. That's like the craziest job thing I've ever heard of. And they're like, well, how do you know? If you've never tried it, maybe you're good at it. So I started directing short films. The first few were pretty bad, as always, is to be expected, but I stuck with it. And I worked my way up the film industry in Argentina. And then I started to direct documentaries. And I started up in comedy, and I really love, you know, I love comedy. And I love working with actors. I did a lot of acting myself. But sometimes, you know, documentaries, you really can be political about it. You can dive into topics that maybe people don't really want to talk about. And that's always been important to me.
Oh, I love that. And I mean, let's just jump right into the Erasing Family. This one is so, it touches a lot of people throughout the whole entire world because there is a lot of family situations where people go through a divorce, and that actually impacts the child more than anyone else, to where, you know, you're living with one parent and you don't necessarily get to see the other parent as much as you should, whether it be every other weekend or just the weekends, or in some cases, like you proved in your documentary, never. That one instance where he signed over his parental rights to the stepfather and the mother, I thought that was just absolutely crazy. And one of the things that just popped into my head, and I'm very curious too, because you say that a lot of people are comfortable around you. They are open to tell you things, not necessarily really knowing who you are, but just knowing your project. So in that situation, I was so curious, how do you come at it at a non-biased standpoint? you know, because you are hearing all the stories about the mother who mm-hmm. kept her away from her father, who she really wanted to be a part of his life. And in turn, he has wanted to be a part of hers as well. How did you come from an unbiased standpoint when interviewing her and when interviewing him?
I was about to say something then, like, I'm going to sound very full of myself, I can say. Well, it's just, you know, I really believe, I'm not Christian, but I really believe in what Jesus said of he who is without sin cast the first stone. Mm-hmm. So I really do try not to judge people.
Right.
Mm-hmm. I actually don't judge people. Of course, I do judge people like everybody else.
Right.
But I think I always come at it from, I don't know what people are dealing with. I don't know the traumas they've done with. And this is an excused behavior, but I just kind of listen. And naturally, when people talk to me and they tell me something, even if maybe I'm like, oh, that's kind of weird or nasty, or I don't like that.
Right.
I don't react to it. I don't push back on it. Mm. And this enables people to open up. Mm-hmm. And what's weird is I actually did a lot of debates, so I can have arguments and debate with people. But I always, even then, I'll ask people, do you want to debate? Mm-hmm. And I let them choose. If they don't, I don't push it out. I think it's much better to ask people questions. And so what I've learned making documentary films is the way to get good answers from people is to ask them to be specific.
Mm. Yeah.
So a lot of times people will be general when they talk. Or they'll use adjectives like, I'm an honest person. Mm-hmm. That person's honest. But it's much better to say, well, give me an example of how you were honest.
I love that. And I think that that's a fantastic approach to be able to do it. And I kind of want to play off of what you just said about mm-hmm. how you do approach it by not judging people. But one of the things that stood out in this documentary for me that I do mm-hmm. want to touch on, because I want to judge the system. And I think you did a very good job of that, because the system, and I'm speaking from my own perspective because of what happened to me, but the system is very female oriented. It's very female friendly towards the mother, and it almost always vilifies the father, even if he's a genuinely good person who has mm-hmm. done everything right by his child. He's now the villain, and it's the mother, 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 mother. That was what I had to go through. My judge was very anti-me, no matter what I said, what I did. And, it, you know, breaking down in tears in a courtroom, confessing that I don't ever want to be without my daughter and not, I don't want to be that guy that doesn't show up. And she's just like brushing me off as I'm some sort of insignificant person in my daughter's life. And they bill family court the whole system as in the best interest of the child, in the best interest of the child. Well, how is that possibly in the best interest of the child, putting the child through not being able to see a parent that they're used to seeing every single day? How is that in the best interest? So talk about how you approached what the system is like and how people are put. Some of these guys are being forced to pay child support and they're taking everything from them. They can't even survive living. It's ridiculous. And then they call them failures. Well, you don't get custody of your kid because you're a failure. You can't even keep a job. It's like, you're taking every cent that I make. I'm doing the best. Like, so how did you approach that? Because I thought it was brilliantly done.
Oh, thank you. So in the documentary Erasing Family, we explore the family court system through the eyes of children, teenagers who've been traumatized by it. Mm-hmm. So again, I think judging a system is different than judging people.
Sure.
And you always need to ask, well, why does the system exist? And part of the reason why child support was invented and existed is really to make sure the children do not become a burden on the state.
Mm. Right.
This is very different than ensuring that the child has support or has love. And part of the result is that it's very easy to go to jail for not paying child support. It's almost impossible to go to jail for interfering with custody. Mm. So we have a very lopsided system. If you want to go really back, it's because it's very hard to be a working family in the United States. It's very hard to live off of one income, let alone two. So there's a lot of systemic structures in there. So this system was kind of designed to replace welfare. But if you have forced income transferences from from one parent to another, we can see that this has very negative effects. Mm-hmm. Now, here's something interesting that I discovered when I did make the film. About half of the people who support a racing family are women. They're moms who can't see their kids. Mm. Now, that does not mean that they're statistically the majority. Women may be more apt to talk about this. They may be more apt to seek help.
Right.
So this is not cause this, because statistically it's the fathers who can't see their kids. But what I found out is that the system is so invested in making money and generating conflict that it really is designed to increase conflict. And again, it's just asking people, you know, asking a lawyer, what's a good strategy in a divorce case? Mm-hmm. And most will say, accuse the other person early, make a horrible accusation. Nothing will happen if it's proven false. And just really go after the other person. And so the system rewards bad behavior. And so it's my judgment is, if people do this, it's because they're rewarded by the system. And if they accuse the other person, slander the other person, and they're rewarded by the family courts, what the documentary Erasing Family shows is they're acting because they're incentivized to do so. Mm-hmm. So I think a key way to reform is to look at the incentives that people have before them. Mm-hmm. And one thing is also asking is court the place that this should be settled? Is an adversarial system the place where family conflicts should be settled? And I'm a firm believer that it is not. That family court is the worst place to throw in a high conflict family that's fighting, that may have mental health issues. Mm-hmm. A lot of people who get embroiled in these high conflict custody cases, one of the parents has a mental health issue. Mm. They might be highly functioning, but they have, you know, narcissistic personality disorder, something like that. And it's rewarded them. Like you even said, well, I cried in front of the judge. And I actually now work with families to coach them through this process. Mm-hmm. And showing up emotional in court is from a strategy standpoint, one of the worst things you can do.
Yeah, yeah.
You're emotional because your children are being torn from you, but you're rewarded by not reacting, which is what a narcissist would do because they don't react because they're not emotional. So I've also, in the past year or so, become a coach for families going through this. I have a whole program, but it's all based on healing and learning new skills. Mm. So, and again, even with that, and I end the film with, let's not try to blame people. Let's try to figure out a way to solve this and to heal, because going back to not judging, mm-hmm. everyone's memory of an event is different.
Right.
It is.
Right.
So to try to figure out what exactly happened, it's futile.
No, I just wanted, and I know you, cause I'm just, for just to put some context out there, yeah. His fiance is my daughter. So he has a perspective of hearing her thoughts on everything that kind of, right. But I want to address what you said, because it was absolutely true. And I want to preface this with, my ex-wife and I are in a very good spot. We are co-parenting, and we have mended things, and we are good friends, and we are in a very good spot, which I know doesn't always happen and isn't always the case. So I want to preface that with, she is a wonderful person and we are in a really good place. We were just in two different things. But you said something that's very, very true, and I think it's a very stark reality. File quickly. Make an accusation that's horrible, that everybody knows isn't true, but you're going to say it anyway, and then be encouraged and rewarded by the court for doing it. That's exactly what happened. She filed first, she made a wild accusation, and the judge rewarded her for it. And even when we proved that it wasn't true with photographic proof and all this kind of, it was brushed off as, that doesn't matter. You said it, you made it, now it's true. And I think that's so important for people to understand that is how the system goes. And when you, like anything, when you are rewarded for something, you're going to continue that action even though you know it's not right. And I truly believe that my ex-wife was a good person and a great mother and continues to be that, but followed down that path because she was rewarded for doing so. And that's devastating. And I don't think people going into it understand that that is how the system works. So I'm so glad that you exposed that and brought that up. Yeah, because it's terrifying. It really is.
Yeah, and I mean, coming from my point of view, I am a product of a divorced family as well. But my parents got divorced when I was 3 years old, so I don't necessarily remember them being together. And it was kind of to a certain point where a step-parent came involved, my stepmother, and it was like kind of this weird, awkward situation to where, like, I don't even really remember having like conversations with both my parents at the same time. Like, I don't know what their relationship would be like. I've really only seen them actually be in the same room a handful of times in my memory. And it's like one of those things that you show brilliantly in this documentary that, you know, some people sometimes make rash decisions in the moment when they're young specifically. And then that kind of just carries on throughout the years to where you feel like you can't revert back or you can't change your mind on something because you would admit fault and you would admit that you might have been acting irrationally at that time. And I think that is so important. And I thought the people you had in this film, the examples, they were brilliant. I absolutely could connect with every single one of their stories, especially when they brought in a step-parent. I remember it saying in the documentary that you posted on Facebook that you'd be, you know, creating something like this or something along those lines, and you had a crazy amount of responses to that. Is that how you found your participants in this documentary, or did you have them before that Facebook post?
So that's a great question. So with the Erasing Telling documentary, I found the participants after I had the idea.
Okay.
So I had already made a film called Erasing Dad or Borrando Papá in Argentina. And when I left Argentina in 2014, I wanted to make a follow-up film.
Mm-hmm.
And again, whenever I start a project, the first thing I just start doing is talking to people. So I basically talked to people who were activists or who were doing public posting to get kind of an idea of what the situation in the United States was like.
Right.
Then none of the people I talked to, I thought would make good characters in a film, because to be a character in a documentary, you not only have to have a great story, you have to be good on camera.
Yes.
And the story ideally should be happening as you film it.
Mm-hmm.
So something that happened 10 years ago is not as good as something that's happening now. Of course, with some of the families who I talked to, the divorce happened 10 years ago, but the reuniting is happening in front of the camera.
Right, right.
So when I made Erasing Dad, social media wasn't a big thing.
Mm.
So I was like, how do I find these people? And it was all through word of mouth, going to courthouses, meetings. But with social media, there's good and bad things about social media.
Yes.
It's great if you want to find people.
Yeah, it is.
You can find anyone in the world or any type of person. And I just started to post. You know, I'm looking for families, and I got so many responses.
Yeah.
To this day, the Erasing Family social media page has 33,000 followers.
Wow.
They're very active. If I do a short video, I'll get hundreds of comments sometimes. So, like, there's a lot of people who are very desperate to tell their stories and who are very desperate for help. And that's what I try to capture, the Erasing Family. So even though I focused on a few stories, and there's a lot more that I filmed that didn't make it into the film, of course.
Right.
At the end, it was very important to me to have those short videos of everybody saying what they had gone through.
Yeah.
Because what I didn't want to do, and this is a film decision, like an aesthetic decision.
Mm-hmm.
Most filmmakers would say, focus on one story and tell the world through that story.
Right. Mm-hmm.
I really didn't want to do that because I didn't want to think this was the viewer to walk away with, wow, that is one crazy family.
Right.
So that was a choice where a lot of filmmakers were like, why don't you stick with one family? It would have been a deeper film. But I didn't want someone to say like, wow, the Jones family, they're really messed up and they made a lot of mistakes. I wanted people to see that this is a problem with the system.
Mm-hmm.
And also, which I don't mention that much in the film, but we are not taught how to have disagreements or to deal with high conflict people.
Yes.
And that is something that could happen during a divorce process or before or in high school. And most people do not have the skills, especially considering that many people come from divorced families So what they have to mirror are their own parents not getting along. Like, or like you just said, you never saw your parents talk to each other. I never saw my parents talk to each other. They were married for the first 13 years of my life. I never saw them talk to each other. Not once. I saw them yell at each other. I saw them talk to each other. But I can't remember, hey, how was your day? Oh, it was great. What'd you do? I have no recollection of that. And the first time I saw, I was being to date a guy, and I went over to his house, and his parents were sitting talking, and I was like, what are they doing? And he goes, they're talking to each other. I was like, what do you mean? He's like, well, they're chatting. And I was like, about what? Like, I was like, kind of like, I had never seen that before in
It's
my
a
life. I was weirded out by it.
it's very interesting to see like all the different because life is just so layered and there's so many different aspects of life that if you're not exposed to it, you have no idea that it's like taboo to you or anyone else. So it's yeah, it's always so interesting to see what the learning curve is and how to go around it and everything like that. And I also want to point out that your creative decisions in the documentary, I felt like were in very well taste. I absolutely love the family tree. Each time you would bounce back and forth between families, I thought that was very important because I feel like sometimes, you lose track of who is in relation to who or what's going on where. So I felt like that was a very nice touch to put in the film to where we could all stay in touch, especially like you said, when you're dealing with multiple different families who are going through different things, you can see, oh, okay, this tree is this and this tree is that. So I just wanted to acknowledge and applaud you on your creative direction because we are filmmakers ourselves. So anytime I any see things like that, I'm always like, we don't necessarily get recognition that we spend so much time on sometimes. And I just, you did a great job. I just want to let you know.
Well, thank you so much. And that came out of screening the film to people and people getting lost with the families.
Okay.
So that's my filmmaking tip, is to show the film to lots of people and get feedback. Don't react to it.
Exactly.
That's right.
Don't
That's the
try to
biggest
argue with
thing.
them. And if a few people say the same thing, then it's like, okay, if people, everyone's like, I can't keep track of the families. And my first thought was, well, everyone has their name.
Yeah, right. Like just there.
But it is true. People do have a hard time keeping track of multiple people. So we invented the family tree. And then also as a director, you might get feedback and have, and then you decide, no, I don't want to do that. But it's good to listen and hear what people say. And I also, one thing I've always done with my films, I always get feedback from people who don't have a high school education.
That's
I'm like,
great.
it has to be understandable by everybody, just not film people. I'll even like categorize, okay, these are film people, and these are like normal people, or these are experts in the subject. And the normal people, they always win out. Because I'm like, film's a mass medium, it should be clear to everybody. It shouldn't use terms that are hard for people. Or you just admit you're making a very specific film for a very specific audience, and there's nothing wrong with that. But you can't just get what people who run film festivals think about films.
Exactly. And what I really love too is you shed light on industries that are like multi-billion or million-dollar industries that necessarily don't like get the notoriety of that's what they're doing and that's what's happening here. Specifically with family stuff and now leading into your next project, Exclusion U, where it's Ivy League colleges making north of $80,000 per student every single year. That is absolutely crazy. So let's dive into that. I mean, just watching it, watching the screener, I learned so much that just isn't necessarily in our everyday life, any everyday conversation. And the acceptance rate is absolutely insane, below 8% basically. The last Ivy League school was like 8.6% acceptance rate. So I mean, the amount of private education that is getting public money is absolutely insane. So I'm really excited to talk about this because we put these Ivy League schools on a pedestal, basically. You
We
know,
do.
these are the schools that's where our leaders come from. That's where like all of these people who we're supposed to look up to and get our information come from. But at the same time, it's kind of like a I put it in quotations as like a boys club or as like a socialized event to where like these certain people will get into this certain organization and basically be set for the rest of their life. So let's dive into it. Talk a little bit about what the premise is. I know I touched on a little bit, but I want to hear it from the filmmaker's mouth herself.
So in full disclosure, I went to an Ivy League school. I went to Columbia University in New York City. I love the education I got. I did not like the institution. I spent most of my undergraduate years protesting in one way or another against the institution.
Right.
So for me, it's like having a school that has rigorous standards and that forms, let's call it an intellectual elite, I think is a good thing. And there might be people disagree with me. I think a school that forms an economic elite is not a good thing. So I think if someone wants to be an astrophysicist or a historian or a philosopher and they have to go through a rigorous selection process and then have a rigorous education, I think that's something that we all benefit from.
Absolutely. Most definitely.
But when these schools are just kind of a way to get certified that you can work on Wall Street or in big tech, I think it's problematic because we're robbing students who maybe would really enjoy learning for learning's sake or becoming intellectuals, writing books, studying things that are obscure. We're robbing them of a place, and then they get so hard to get into because of the doors that they open afterwards. And because there's so few spots, because these schools have not expanded at all, they are, even though they have more money, they're not opening new campuses, they're not opening up new slots, they're not opening up new schools. They're not using their money that they're sitting on.
Right.
So it's just all these people are missing out on a great education. And again, if these were truly private schools, we could still have a problem with it. But the fact that they receive so much public money and they don't pay taxes. So Harvard right now, well, last year, I'm sure it's more, they had $55 billion, with a B, billion dollars in their endowment.
Right.
What an endowment is, the way people can understand, it's a fund that you invest, and then you, the institution, take some of the interest or some of the profit, not all of it, to actually fund your operations. So you never touch the principal. You never touch the original donation. So this means if somebody like Harvard got donations 400 years ago when it opened, those donations are still growing. They've never been touched.
Right.
And Harvard always says, well, we need it in case something happens, an emergency, like COVID.
Right.
Like, you know, but so does every business.
Right.
Harvard has income streams, like you said, that the students pay tuition, $80,000 a year. They have contracts. They, you know, have, they have grad school programs. They have certificates. They have a publishing house. So it's not like they're not making money. So why are we subsidizing? It's basically a tax-free hedge fund, and it's all legal.
Yeah.
So, there's so much debate now about education and what students are learning in school. I haven't been in school for 20 years. I did not touch that really in the film because that's another film. I don't know what's true or what's not.
So right.
I'm just like, well, what are the facts? The money is the fact, and also how these schools that everyone say, oh, they're so woke, how they really treat the students from disadvantaged backgrounds who go there, and a lot of them talked about how isolated they felt,
right,
how lonely they felt, how hard they had to work, even though they got a free scholarship,
right,
to pay for other expenses. They would spend 20 hours a week working, which, you know, is normal, but if you're at a school where nobody else does that because everyone else is very wealthy, you're at a disadvantage academically, but also making friends and networks, which is kind of the point of the school.
Right.
So, and there's one girl in the film, Hannah, who goes to Harvard. She's the granddaughter of a housekeeper. And at Harvard, she scrubs toilets. And it's part of a Harvard program to help students who need money. And they're very clear to say, well, there's some students who are rich who just like to scrub toilets. So you can choose not to do this program. No one's forced into it. I want to make that very clear.
Yeah.
But I was just like, this is so weird that a school that has that much money gives a scholarship to this, you know, working class Latina girl from LA. so she doesn't have to scrub toilets the rest of her life, and then she scrubs toilets.
And then she still does.
Yeah,
it. Yeah,
yeah.
But I was just like, this is just weird, you know? Like, it's just kind of odd, you know? And they have enough money, and you're like, they can't throw this girl a few thousand bucks so she doesn't have to scrub toilets.
Right,
exactly. Yeah,
which is humiliating. And it seems a little tone deaf too. Mm-hmm. And you know, and there's a, and then so what I want to do with this is, I grew up in Long Island.
Mm-hmm.
Going to Ivy League school is a big thing in Long Island. Mm-hmm. There's a lot of pressure to get into one, but it's not like that in all the country. So I want to let people know who maybe are not exposed to these schools, the outsized role that they play in getting in power in politics, and also in getting money from taxpayers.
Right. Yes, definitely.
It's like they've ended up in this position, like you said, they've kind of inherited this prestige. Do they really deserve it?
Right.
Well, and so I'm glad that you brought this to light, because I think that there's a lot of misunderstanding. People don't understand when you say private university, how are they getting public money? Like, you know, because people think private, it's being funded completely by donations or by, you know, former alumni, these type things. What, so to have it come to light that private universities are receiving public taxpayer money, and how is this possible? Why is this a thing? So talk a little bit more about that. Like, right. Make the clarification of what is public money that's being funneled to a private university, and how is that legal? Like, because you brought that up,
oh, yeah.
And this is all legal. So why are taxpayers footing the bill for a private university? What is the deal? Talk a bit about that a little bit.
So we have a very complicated tax system.
Yes.
So the government can give anybody it wants money.
Right.
Veterans get money. Veterans are private people, and they get government money. Just to give it an example that most people would be in agreement with.
Right.
A lot of private schools will also get subsidies. I went to a private school for a while, and I know that the bus was subsidized by the state. So we took a public school bus to go to a private school.
Right.
Now, with universities, there's a few ways. So most people listening to this have probably heard of a Pell Grant. A Pell Grant is a scholarship the government gives to low-income students.
Mm-hmm. Uh-huh.
Now that goes to the school. So if Harvard admits a Pell Grant student, Harvard gets that Pell Grant,
mm-hmm.
right? They also get other financial aid grants. But also, if we fund research at Harvard, they get a grant.
Mm-hmm.
Right.
And then also what we count too, and there's a lot of other grants, not just for research, that they would get. And then also, let's say they, and then I think what we also count with the subsidies too is, they don't pay any local, state, or federal tax.
Mm-hmm. Right.
So Harvard is like one of the largest landowners in Boston.
Mm-hmm.
What is that land worth? What is the tax they're not paying?
Yeah.
And that also like really, you know, upset me too, because not just like Harvard, but for example, University of Pennsylvania is in a very poor district of Philadelphia.
Mm-hmm.
The public schools are ridden with lead and asbestos rats.
Mm-hmm.
And you have the largest landowner not paying taxes.
Yeah. That's
Columbia, the school I went to, is in Harlem. Mm-hmm. You know, like there's a lot of examples like this. Again, if they were offering, you know, a near free education to people, if they were using all of their endowment, and because the law is very clear. Any educational institution in the U.S. is tax-free.
Mm-hmm.
So we often think of tax-free as charitable, but there's another institution that's education and does not have to be charitable. So the film questions, is it time to change the law so only educational institutions that are charitable have a tax exemption?
Right.
So schools that, you know, are near-free, that use their endowments, and there's very few of them. I remember looking at a list of schools that offer free education in the U.S. There's less than 12.
So you have
the military academies, and you have a few other schools that offer free education, where just anyone who goes gets a free ride. And then often public universities can be more expensive than Ivy League universities.
Mm-hmm.
For middle class students. I mean, it depends, and I don't get too into the weeds with this. This is a whole complicated discussion. But we have a very complicated and overpriced educational system.
Mm-hmm.
And one thing that worries me is that more and more people will opt out of going to college.
Right. Yeah.
I think getting a college education is wonderful. Getting a liberal arts education, hell, taking what people make fun of, fluffy courses, being exposed to philosophy, art, filmmaking, it's wonderful.
Mm-hmm.
But if that costs $80,000 a year.
Right. Yeah.
Then it is stupid.
It is.
So, and that's my concern is that if you just look at this as an investment, yeah, you don't make your money back on the investment.
Yeah.
Well, and I like what you said, though, too, about how people justify it's okay or not okay. You brought up the veterans, right? Like, it's okay. We subsidize veterans. We give them free money and that people are okay with that. But where I'm at, like, with that is like, well, this veteran that I'm giving tax money to help him out, he doesn't have a friend that's giving him $80,000 a year on top of that. Like, these universities, they're collecting $80,000 from each student. Why do they need that help? Why aren't you spending that money on research, on helping children who don't have money to go, paying, like, as you said, giving them the free ride without having to scrub the toilets and stuff?
And they have donations, too.
And donations.
So what we talk about in the film is that in the film Exclusion You, one thing that we talk about, too, is that it's kind of a great scam. I'm not sure if you guys remember the classic film Trading Places.
Yes. Yeah.
Where Eddie Murphy, where he learns how to stock trade, and he's like, well, I'm a hustler, and I just see a hustle. You know,
right.
I know a hustle, and I see one. That's why he's good at stock trading, right? This is a great hustle.
Mm-hmm.
Because if you're a rich parent and you want your kid to get into a school, Harvard will say, well, we won't promise if you make a donation, your kid will get in. But if you give us at least $10, $20 million, and it's only very clear that's what it takes for you to be noticed, it might help.
Right, right.
So it's a great way to get these huge donations with no guarantee of everything. And then also something, too, that's important about these donations is, it's not just parents who have kids who are going to go to the school.
Mm-hmm.
I talked to a very wealthy man who was hit up by his alma mater for a donation. And he made it very clear, you donate $10 million, you get to pick a few people each year.
Mm. Yeah. Wow.
And now think about it. If you're doing business at a high level and you're someone you want to close a deal with, it's like, oh, my kid really wants to go to Yale, but they can't get in. And you can say, let me make a phone call.
Right.
Right.
They're going to close a contract with you.
Mm, that's exactly.
So this is very cyclical and it's very legal because that's why the admission system is so opaque, because then you can say, well, we admitted this student who gave a donation whose grades aren't as good enough, but we also admitted this other student because they're a lacrosse player, or this student. So it's all very nebulous about who gets in. No one knows who gets in and why.
Right.
You know, so it's, and that just creates stress for all of the students who are applying,
because mm-hmm.
you really don't know. And the students who have the money will apply now to 20 schools.
Mm. Yeah, exactly. And I mean, it kind of goes back to what we were talking about a little bit earlier, like the social club, you know, the mm-hmm. possibly, you know, able to use that as ammo for different mm-hmm. instances. It's kind of a crazy situation. I love, too, how you brought up multiple different examples of past things that were a little bit shady when it comes to these private universities. For example, the Harvard instance when it came to Jewish people. That whole situation was, I mean, and lack of a better term, fascinating to me, because I never even would have imagined that would be crossing someone's mind. But to try to keep the certain type of person in your education system, to where you would implement all of these extra and different steps to where you could, you know, exclude certain people that you wouldn't want in there. And just all of these different things, like that and the Asian situation that was a couple mm-hmm. of years ago, I believe in 2018.
Yeah.
I mean, just all of these different things that necessarily, specifically Caucasian people, white people, don't necessarily think about all the time. So I think it's very, very eye-opening, because we always talk about how entertainment is the best form of education. So it's really good to show people that, you know, all of these different things are necessary.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Completely agree.
Yeah, so what you're talking about is that when you have a system that's unclear, of who gets in, you can use it to promote bias. So you can have bias against Jewish students, you have bias against Asian students, you know, bias against anybody.
Mm-hmm.
And because the system is so unclear, and as we talk about exclusion U, it's very easy just to use this to fulfill your own needs as an institution.
Right.
Yes, most definitely.
Well, I think a great way to wrap it up is to take it back to something that you said when dealing with education. If you are talking about an elitist level, and you are talking about education, the best of the best, and we want the best of the best leaders, we want the best intellects in the world, that's great. But when you flip it to we're elitist because of money and economic status, and you brought up that great example of, hey, I have to sign this deal with this guy, so I'm going to get his kid in because I have the money to do that, right? Then it's a problem. And I think that's a great way to wrap it up. There's nothing wrong with being an elitist intellect. There is definitely something wrong with being an elitist because you have money and you are able to deny an intellect the ability to be an intellect at the elite level because they don't have the money. There's where it's wrong. And thank you for highlighting that. Thank you for highlighting the problems with the system in family court and with the system in education, because both are big problems, and how we address those problems is starting conversations. And you're doing that with these documentaries, and that's so important.
Well, thank you so much for having me on here.
Yeah.
It was great talking. I love talking about the process, and I love the questions about how I interview people. Honestly, no one's ever asked me that before.
Well, good. We always love it.
And I love talking about it. But for just to remember to people, if you just listen, people will reveal almost anything. And you don't have to ask. And I'm always surprised that people tell me that without asking.
Agreed. Agreed.
So if people want to find me,
yes,
it's my full, I'll just give some easy ways for people to find me. The easiest one is my full name, gingergenteel.com.
Okay.
And there you have all the links to all my projects. And Exclusion U will be streaming June 23rd on all major platforms. So we're excited about that. And if people want to find Erasing Family, erasingfamily.org. And if also people are going through this and wanted help with their situation in family court, they can also find me at reversingparentalalienation.com.
Love it.
All good things.
And Erasing Family is free to watch on YouTube. So it's open to anybody.
Well, thank you so much again for coming on the show. And we'll be sure to direct everybody all over. And open invite. Anytime you would like to come back on and talk about another project, promote anything, or we have a mental health project too that we didn't even really touch on. But it was such an enlightening conversation. So just thank you. Thank you so much for your time today.
Thank you.
Of talk course. Soon. Bye.
All right,
have
take
a good
care.
One. Oh my goodness. Talk about just an informative conversation about topics that are affecting us every single day, but we don't necessarily dive into.
Yeah. And you know what, too, the one thing that struck me and that I'm you don't see very often is you see a lot of people doing documentaries and exposing these things, but then they move on.
Yeah.
I love the fact that she's done these documentaries and then she's following through with helping families that need help that are going through it. She didn't just expose it and move on. She's like, this is an issue. Let me see what I can do to continue to help. I love that. That's that. And I feel like she's doing that with education too, saying, what can I do to help you get into a school so you don't do toilets and you don't do that? I love that. And so kudos to her for not only bringing light to these situations, but continuing to help after she's exposed these situations. So.
Completely agree. Exclusion U, June 23rd. Be sure to check it out on all places. We'll be sure to promote that where you can find it. We're super excited about it. And go watch Erasing Family as well, because that one is a good one. I watched it on Tubi. It is available on YouTube or her website, like she said. But thank you again, Ginger, for coming on the show.